All right, I'd like you to take your Bibles this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here is Ted Weiland.
This will be Bible Law versus Constitutionalism, Part 6. As you know, or certainly should know by now, Psalms chapter 19 and verse 7 declares that Yahweh's law is perfect. The Hebrew word tamim, translated perfect, is the same word, used, for example, for the Passover lamb and other sacrifices representing Yeshua, translated unblemished. They were to be an unblemished lamb or an unblemished sacrifice. They were to be a perfect sacrifice. Why? Because they represented Yeshua the Christ. And all of this, not only the perfection, the unblemished aspect of the different sacrifices that represented Yeshua, but the unblemished aspect or the perfection of the law, all of this makes sense. Because in order for Yeshua to be perfect or unblemished, think about it, Yahweh's law word also must still be perfect as well. Why? Because John chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 14, Yahshua was the Word, and therefore His law as well, as a part of that Word, was made flesh and dwelt among us. And therefore what? Because if we accept that He's perfect, therefore what He was before He was incarnated and became the Son of God, must have been perfect as well, including the law aspect, which is the biggest majority of His word. And therefore, to reject Yahweh's perfect law in any sense is, in that sense, to also reject Yeshua the Christ, because He was the law made flesh. Yahweh's law is perfect, but by any stretch of the imagination, no matter how good someone may claim that it is, would anyone dare declare that the United States Constitution is perfect? Yeah, I really don't think that they would. Now, I wouldn't be totally surprised if somebody doesn't try to do it, but I really don't think that they would, because to counter such a claim, you would only have to ask, why then did it have to be amended if it was perfect? If it had been perfect, and I think I pointed this out in one of the previous messages, but let me say it again. If it had been perfect, it would have been redundant. It had been just a repetition of what we already know is perfect. And because it's clearly not perfect, who wants it? Not when we can have perfection. And we can. It's just a matter of taking it, grabbing it, and running with it. So why would you want it since it's not perfect? But there is much more to be concerned about regarding the Constitution than simply its imperfection. We've already witnessed that in the preamble, in the first part of Article 1, and we barely even scratched the surface there. And we're only into Article 1, and we've already proven that point, that there is much more to be concerned about than simply its imperfection. Furthermore, if ever there was an unequally yoked wedding, it's the marriage that so many patriots today, so many quote-unquote today's constitutionalists today, are trying to bring about between the laws of Yahweh and the Constitution of the United States of America. If ever there was an unequally yoked marriage, that's it. Unmistakably demonstrated, I believe, but often missed, in the oath of office that I mentioned at the end of last week's message. And I want to bring it up again, because before last week, I had never caught the irony, the duplicity, and the treachery, in the oath the president and other public officials have been taking for over two centuries now, placing their hand on the Bible and swearing not to uphold the laws of the Bible or the laws of the God of the Bible, but instead putting their hand on the Bible and then turning around and swearing to uphold the idolatrous, pluralistic, polytheistic Constitution of the United States of America. I had never before caught the even the irony in doing that. Listen, that's as oxymoronic as is the term Judeo-Christianity. And don't miss, just as Judaism gets the primacy in the term Judeo-Christianity, the Constitution gets supremacy in the United States Oath of Office. In fact, isn't that exactly what most constitutionalists identify the Constitution as the supreme law of the land? Not the Bible, not Yahweh's laws, but the Constitution as the supreme, I mean, there's nothing higher than that, let's face it, as the supreme law of the land. And that, my friends, is nothing short of treason or sedition against Yahweh. In the last message, I pointed out that for someone to put their hand on the Bible and to swear to uphold the Constitution is no different than those in 2 Kings 17, or what those in 2 Kings 17 did, who are described as fearing Yahweh, at least that's what they claimed, while serving, upholding, same thing, upholding the laws. That's what you do when you serve another god or another king, you uphold, serving is upholding that king's or that God's laws, while they are described as fearing Yahweh, at least that's what they claimed, while serving, while upholding the laws of the gods Succoth-Benoth, Nergal, Ashima, Nibhaz, Tartak, Adrammelech, and Anemelech. You might want to read that sometime. It's also the same as what's described in Zephaniah chapter 1 and verses 4 and 5. Won't turn there, but you can listen to this. It says, "And I will also stretch out my hand upon Judah and upon all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place and the name of the Chimerims with the priest." Verse 5. And listen, and that makes, great, he's going to cut off the Chimerims. He's going to cut off all of the Baals. And then it says, "And them that worship the host of heaven upon the housetops," first commandment transgression there, "and them," now catch this, "and them that worship and swear by Yahweh." Wait a minute, why in the world would he say that? Because you got to read the rest of the verse. He says he's going to cut off the Balaam, he's going to cut off all the other gods, and he's going to cut off them that worship and swear by Yahweh and that swear by Malcolm, another god, a god of the Moabites. Swearing by his name, something the Bible does command, if it's done in the right way, for the right purpose. Swearing by his name and swearing on the Bible means nothing to Yahweh. Not if, at the same time, you are also swearing in the name of another god along with his, or at the same time swearing to keep the laws of another god's constitutions, as in we the peoples, rather than Yahweh our gods, I should say. It means nothing to him, the fact that you put your Bible, your hand on the Bible and swear by it. Not if you are also swearing, in so doing, you are swearing to uphold another God's constitutions. In Yahweh's eyes, that has to be nothing but a pretense at the best and subterfuge at the worst. Moving on, this past week I received four different ministry mail-outs that all made mention of the Constitution. And that's not unusual. That's one of the reasons why I felt it was, along with the fact of this big push for Ron Paul, who is a very strong constitutionalist, for president. But because there is so much out there that I receive, emails that are being passed here and there from different, not just people who claim to be constitutionalists, but most of the mainline evangelical fundamental ministries that in some way or some fashion are often promoting the Constitution. And this past week, I received four different ministry mail-outs, or email-outs, if you will, in some cases, that all made mention of the Constitution. And while I know this is going to extend this series, at least by one message, I've got to comment on these before getting back to the Constitution itself, which I hope to at least get back to by the end of this message, if time doesn't run out. The first one is, you might guess, Chuck Baldwin's, who puts one out about every week and almost inevitably always mentions the Constitution or the framers of the Constitution. It's Chuck Baldwin's July 10th email commentary with reference to the Founding Fathers, meaning the framers of the Constitution. He wrote the following, quote, "Can you imagine a nation without the IRS? Can you imagine a nation with little crime and where children were free to play in schools? Can you imagine a nation where the father's income was able to adequately provide for his household? Can you imagine a country, with low divorce rates and where virtually everyone with a high school diploma could both read and write and was capable of earning his or her way in society? Can you imagine a nation without the ACLU or the NEA? Can you imagine a country that did not legally murder its own unborn children and that would not pander to sexual deviants or criminals? Can you imagine a country that did not glorify, much less sponsor, gambling? Can you imagine a nation with strong state governments and a limited federal government? Can you imagine a country where you could order a firearm through a catalog and there was no such thing as the BATF? Well, you might not be able to imagine such a country, but that was the kind of nation our founders dreamed about, fought for, and bequeathed to their posterity. Unfortunately, since World War II, we Americans have seemed willing to squander the sacrifice and repudiate the principles of our ancestors. With the way things are going, can you imagine what this nation will be like in another 50 years? End of quote. And as you can see, this is meant to be an appeal by Baldwin to a more pure constitutionalism, at least as he sees a more pure constitutionalism. But Chuck, I keep trying to appeal to the guy. I keep emailing him and trying to get him to respond, but he refuses to. But maybe he'll get to hear this message someday. Chuck. You know, why go back to the document that got us into this mess in the first place? Not especially when we could go back to the one which is far superior. And I think he'd even admit that. And offers all of what he suggested in that commentary and much more. Outside of his mention of public schools and state governments, neither of which are a very good idea, and some people may say, well, I can understand you want to get a rich federal government, but you definitely got to have state government. Not necessarily. God's plan, his perfect laws don't require for state government, it just requires for even more localized governments. But outside of mention of his use of public schools or his mention of public schools and state governments, all of that is available with much less government interference. No president, no Senate, no House of Representatives, no bureaucracy that goes with it, and all of the rigmarole that comes with all of that. If we'd only return to Yahweh's perfect laws. Why, Chuck? Why do you want to go back to the inferior document, no matter how good you think it is? The second was a letter from Coral Ridge Ministries, their July 2007 letter that they sent out through the mail. And it begins by quoting Psalms 35 in part, and I'll read what they have quoted here. Quote, "Plead my cause, O Lord." Of course, that Lord should there be Yahweh, so there's no mistake of what Lord is being spoken of in Psalms 35. He says, "Plead my cause, O Yahweh, with them that strive with me. Fight against them that fight against me. Stop the way against them that persecute me. Say unto my soul, I am thy salvation." End of Psalms 35 in part, followed by this statement. And they say, opening lines of Psalms 35, read in Congress, September 7th, 1774. Immediately following that quotation and notation, the actual letter begins. And as I read it to you, I want you to try to figure out what's wrong with this letter, at least this part of it, and we're going to read some other parts as well. It begins, of course, "Dear friends, I am writing to ask you to take action. The very foundations of our nation are in danger of being destroyed, but by God's grace and for His glory, America's Christian foundations can be saved." By the way, this is a very typical letter from Coral Ridge Ministries. "Let me tell you how. Read the above scripture. The words are from Psalms 35, the psalm that Reverend Jacob Duché read to open the meeting of the First Continental Congress on September 7th, 1774, as America's forefathers gathered to discuss our conflict with Britain. In other words, when America's leaders met to discuss independence, they began with a Bible study followed by a lengthy and fervent prayer time. But how many Americans, even Christians, know this? And how many Americans know that our founding fathers, whom the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and secular historians claim were non-Christian deists, actually built America on the Bible? Not many. These critical facts are being obscured by those actively working to destroy our biblical foundations." End of quote. Quite a plea. Probably touches the emotional heart feelings of a lot of Americans out there, Christian Americans in particular. What's wrong with what I just read? Now, first, I want you to note how the terms Congress, in that notation at the beginning under Psalms 35, First Continental Congress, and Founding Fathers are all used interchangeably in that short paragraph for the purpose of establishing that the Constitution is a Christian document. And this is not something uncommon at all. This is widespread for anyone who, any fundamental evangelical Christian organization that it is going to address that period of history and the Constitution, refer to the Constitution or the framers. What we just saw there is not uncommon at all. But I dare say that the average American, non-Christian and Christian alike, would not catch the problem with what Brian Fisher, executive vice president of Coral Ridge Ministries, wrote. In fact, I doubt that he even knows the problem with what he wrote. At least I hope he didn't do what he did intentionally. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Here's the problem. Not knowing history, he mixed up and distorted history. To begin with, the First Continental Congress convened, as he said, on September 7th, 1774, and later versions of the same, are not the same thing as the Constitutional Convention assembled 13 years later in 1787. Most people would not think to differentiate between the Continental Congress and the Constitutional Convention. And he certainly did not in what he wrote, or at least in what he implied. They're not the same thing at all. Not even close to being the same thing. What few Americans have been told is that in addition to effectively removing Christianity from the public arena, the Constitutional Convention was a covert conspiracy for the purpose of overthrowing the government and the Articles of Confederation upon which it was based, established by the Continental Congress. Most people, I don't think there's probably more than probably 1,000 in the entire United States that probably knows that. And that may be given them the benefit of the doubt. But it was a covert operation for the purpose of overthrowing the government already established upon the Articles of Confederation. And therefore, even with some of the same men present in both groups, A few men were also from both groups were present even at the Constitutional Convention. But even with that being the case, unless the Constitutional Convention did the same thing the Continental Congress did, that is, begin with Bible study and lengthy and fervent prayer, and they did not, the two are not comparable. And what occurred on September 17th, 1774 cannot be used to prove anything about what occurred in 1787. You see the faulty reasoning now in what we just read? Later in the same letter, under a heading called Exposing the ACLU's ACLU's Ugliest Myth, we find the following. Quote, the ACLU and others insist that our nation's founders wanted America's government free from religious influence, especially Christian influence. They have used the myth about the so-called separation of church and state to take prayer out of school, the Ten Commandments out of courtrooms, and God out of public life. End of that quote from that letter. Now, let me tell you, as much as I hate agreeing with the ACLU, not so much because of Jefferson's separation of church and state statement, but because Article 6, but because of Article 6, I have to agree with the ACLU. Right straight from the Constitution itself. I have to agree with the ACLU. The, quote, quoting them, nation's founders, and let me stop right there, meaning in this instance, the framers. They were not the nation's founders. They were the constitutional government's founders. The nation's founders were way back in the early 1600s. So don't let that confusion overwhelm you. Now, back to their quote, quoting what supposedly comes from the ACLU and basically does, where it says, quote, I'm going to change it from nation to government. Our government's founders wanted America's government free from religious influence, especially Christian influence. End of quote. I don't like agreeing with them, but it's a fact. It's true. I'm sorry, modern-day patriots, who usually do not even know the difference between the Constitutional Congress and the Constitutional Convention. The ACLU is regrettably right on this point, and has, as a result, been able to use it to take prayer out of the schools and the Ten Commandments out of the courtrooms and God out of public life. And the answer to the ACLU is not to try to prove what cannot be historically proven about the Constitution, but to throw out constitutional government and its progeny government we have today and establish government in its place based solely upon Yahweh's perfect laws. You want to deal with the ACLU? You want to get rid of them? You want to destroy their organization? Quit trying to prove what cannot be proved about the Constitution and throw it out. They're right. It had the intention of taking away religious influence and particularly Christian influence on the government. We will prove that and when we get to Article 6 in our dissection of the Constitution. The letter continues, quote, we must expose the separation lie and replace it with truth. For example, lie. Thomas Jefferson's phrase, wall of separation, Thomas Jefferson's phrase, wall of separation, meant freedom from religion. Truth. In fact, the documented evidence is clear that he meant freedom of religion. Not freedom from religion, but freedom of religion. And for the most part, that's correct, if not totally accurate. But what so few patriots and constitutionalists understand is that the truth is worse, or at least just as bad as the lie. The truth again. The documented evidence is clear that his wall of separation statement meant freedom of religion. End of quote. Freedom of religion? Everybody touts that as something so great. Freedom of religion. Christian patriots, we have been hanging our hats on that for far too long without thinking about just what we're hanging our hats on. Freedom of religion? What exactly is that, I ask you? I mean, for the first time, some people are finally going to start thinking about that phrase. What exactly is that, and how do you think Yahweh thinks about it? Well, I'll tell you what it is. Freedom of religion, freedom of religion, is first and second commandment violations, or at least provisions for first and second commandment violations. Placing or having other gods before Yahweh your God. And if you don't already know, you can read what Yahweh thinks about it in Deuteronomy 13. In fact, let's turn there and let's read it together. Deuteronomy 13, and let's begin with verse 6. In fact, you probably should read sometime this whole entire chapter regarding this question. What does he think about freedom of religion? It's all right here in many, 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 many other places in the entire Bible. But particularly here, what does Yahweh think about it? Beginning in chapter 13 and beginning with verse 6. Follow with me. It says, if thy brother, the son of thy mother, or thy son, or thy daughter, or the wife of thy bosom, or thy friend which is as thine own soul, entice thee secretly, covertly perhaps, saying, let us go and serve other gods. That's called freedom of religion. Which thou hast not known, thou nor thy fathers, namely of the gods of the people which are round about you. Interesting, I hadn't caught that before. The gods of the people. There's two ways to look at that. The people's gods or the gods of the people. We the people. Which are round about you, nigh unto thee and far off from thee, from the one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. Verse 8, thou shalt not consent unto him nor hearken unto him. But it doesn't end just there. Neither shall thine eye pity him, neither shall thou spare, neither shall thou conceal him, but thou shalt surely kill him. Thine hand shall be the first upon him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. And thou shalt stone him with stones that he die, because he has sought to thrust thee away from Yahweh thy God, which brought thee out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. Verse 11, and all Israel shall hear and fear, and shall do no more any such wickedness as this is among you. And if you continue from that point on, we won't read it. But it goes on to say, if a whole community or a town does the same thing, entices and goes after another god other than Yahweh, you're to tear the town down and kill everyone therein. Now, I'll tell you what he thinks about it. It's flat out, simply put, it's a capital crime. Freedom of religion is a capital crime. And like it or not, if you believe, if you truly believe that Yahweh's laws are perfect, and that his judgments are true and righteous altogether, instead of being eulogized, Jefferson should have been executed had they been following Yahweh's laws at the time. Because thanks to good old Tom Jefferson and his other constitutional buddies, America is no longer the Christian nation like she was in the 1600s, but has become probably the most pluralistic, polytheistic nation on the entire globe. And we witnessed one of the horrific consequences of that just this last week, which we'll deal with and look at in the next letter that I'll get into. But before going there, for anyone who just can't fathom such a thing, I mean, going back to capital punishment for first and second commandment transgressions for freedom of religion here in America. If you can't fathom that, and I'm sure a lot of people cannot fathom that, let me remind you that at the time, when America was Christian, back at the time of America's true founders, that a part of the colony of New Haven, Connecticut's fundamental agreement read, in fact, it wasn't just the fundamental agreement, it was the preamble of the fundamental agreement that read, quote, should sound familiar, whosoever shall worship any other God than the Lord, once again, it should have been Yahweh, shall be put to death. What a difference. What a difference from America's true founders and what they demanded as it concerned for freedom of religion and what Tom Jefferson and his constitutional buddies ended up doing when it came to freedom of religion. One demanded demanded monotheism, and not just any monotheism, but only worship of Yahweh, the God of the Bible, whereas the other one opened it up to worshiping any God. Now, there's much more that I could and would like to comment on this that second letter, but for the sake of time, I'll refrain from doing so. The next ministry letter, or email in this instance, is the July 10th, 2007 action alert that many people across this country received from Don Wildman's ministry, the American Family Association. He begins in that his email began with the following. He said, quote, Hindu to open Senate with prayer. That's the title of the email. He goes on, send an email to your senator now expressing your disappointment in the Senate's decision to invite a Hindu to open the session with prayer. Dear Ted, please read this news report from onenewsnow.com. On Thursday, a Hindu chaplain from Reno, Nevada, by the name of Rajan Zed, is scheduled to deliver the opening prayer in the U.S. Senate. Zed tells the Las Vegas Sun that in his prayer, he will likely include references to ancient Hindu scriptures, including, not sure I'll get the pronunciation right, Rig Veda, R-I-G, new word, V-E-D-A, Upan or Umpan Ishards, and Bhagavad Gita, best pronunciation I can give you. Historians believe it will be the first Hindu prayer ever read at the Senate since it was formed in 1789. End of quote. By the way, this is talking about happening last week. By the way, it did occur on Thursday, July 12th. Now, let me skip over. We're going to come back to the action alert. Let me skip over now to CNSnews.com and their comments, some of their comments about this event. Entitled Three Removed from Senate During Hindu Prayer by Nathan Birchfile, July 12, 2007. Quote, quote, and then quote within a quote, may our study be enlightening, end of quote within a quote. He said that, noting that, quote within a quote, by devotion to selfless work, we gain the supreme goal of life, end of quote. Zed addressed his prayer to the Supreme One and requested that, quote within a quote, he stimulate and illuminate our minds, end of quote within a quote. I'm not going to quit doing the quotes within a quotes, but there are some within. Hopefully you'll figure it out where they belong. May yours, going on, he says, may your spirits be as one, Zed said. Peace, peace, peace be unto all, he added, a prayer of comfort for the family of Lady Bird Johnson, the former First Lady, who died Wednesday at 94. Excuse me, Zed addressed a mainly empty Senate chamber, among other staff. And by the way, I don't think that's unusual when they have prayer in the mornings. Most of them aren't there. But Zed addressed a mainly empty Senate chamber, among other staff, only Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, and Senator James Inhofe, is that Inhofe? Forget how you pronounce his name, Republican of Oklahoma, were present for the opening invocation and Pledge of Allegiance. Reid's office, by the way, Reid, don't forget, is a Mormon. Reid's office sponsored Zed's request to serve as a guest chaplain. Inhofe was there to deliver a speech moments later on the Fairness Doctrine. After the prayer, Reid, again a Mormon, took to the floor to thank Zed for opening the Senate. He spoke of the statue of Gandhi he keeps in his office and encouraged his colleagues to, quote unquote, within a quote, think of Gandhi, end of quote, within a quote. As Cybercast News Service previously reported, Zed is believed by Senate historians to be the first Hindu chaplain to deliver the opening prayer on the Senate floor, end of quote. And by the way, praise Yahweh, there were three in attendance there on the Senate floor that objected and were hauled off and arrested and then hauled off, I guess you'd say. In fact, we'll read about that in the next here. This is the fourth ministry letter that I'm talking about, or it's not really it's a Newswire email that addresses this as well. ChristianNewsWire.com, titled "Theology Moved to the Senate and Was Arrested." Quote, "Theology has moved from the church house onto the floor of the United States Senate and has been arrested." Washington, July 12th, Christian Newswire. Kathy Pavkovic and Kristen Sugar were all arrested in the chambers of the United States Senate as that chamber was violated by a false Hindu god. The Senate was opened with a Hindu prayer placing the false god of Hinduism on a level playing field with the one true God, Jesus Christ. Here's what I want to refer to particularly. This would have never been allowed by our founding fathers. Not one senator had the backbone to stand as our founding fathers stood. They stood on the gospel of Jesus Christ. End of quote. And that is true. If you're talking about our true founding fathers of the 1600s. But don't bet on it if you're talking about the founding fathers of the United States Constitution. Continuing with the Christian Newswire article, it says, the Senate chaplain, Reverend Barry Black, usually delivers the invocation, but it's common for guest chaplains to appear. While he appears to be the first Hindu to open the Senate, Zed is not the first outside the Judeo-Christian tradition. A Muslim prayer was delivered in 1993, end of quote. And if my memory serves me correctly, I think there's been one other time since 1993, that a Muslim has opened the prayer in the Senate, or perhaps it was at the House, if they even do it at the House. And there's been, I guarantee you there's been rabbis. There's been at least one, if not two, Muslims that have now done it, and now a Hindu. And hold on to your shirts. Because I say, why not? Why not? Now, I'll explain that question statement in just a little bit. But first, back to Wildman's Action Alert email. He goes on and writes the following. He says, quote, Wall Builders President David Barton is questioning why the U.S. government is seeking the invocation of a non-monotheistic god. Barton points out that since Hindus worship multiple gods, the prayer will be completely outside the American paradigm, flying in the face of the American motto, One Nation Under God. In Hindu, you have not one god, but many, 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 many gods. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I think I got them all. The Christian historian explains, speaking of Barton. And certainly that was never in the minds of those who did the Constitution, did the Declaration of Independence, when they talked about the Creator. That's not the one that fits here, because we don't know which Creator we're talking about with the Hindu religion. Going on, it says, Barton says, given the fact that Hindus are a tiny constituency of the American public, he questions the motivation of Senate leaders. This is not a religion that has produced great things in the world, he observes. You look at India, you look at Nepal. There's persecution going on in both of those countries that is gendered by the religious belief that is present there, and Hindu dominates in both of those countries. End of quote from Barton as well. Now, that sounds like pretty sound reasoning, doesn't it? I think the average person, the average Christian would say, go Dave Barton. Or David Barton, as I should say. Barton's noted for sound reasoning and honesty as well. Note the next paragraph. Quote, and while Barton acknowledges that there is not a constitutional problem with a Hindu prayer in the Senate, he wonders about the political side of it. One definitely wonders about the pragmatic side of it, he says. What is the message and why is the message needed? And will it actually communicate anything other than engender with folks like me a lot of questions? End of quote, within a quote, and end of quote. Now, back to my former question. Why not? Why not? Article 6 of the Constitution provides for this. And by removing the provision of religious, Christian, not just religious, Christian test oaths in particular, and Amendment 1 and Thomas Jefferson's separation statement sealed it. So why not? Barton's statement again. He says, and while Barton, or reference to the state, one of Barton's statement, Wildman says, quote, and while Barton acknowledges there is not a constitutional problem with a Hindu prayer in Senate, and he goes on, end of quote. Hello? Anybody home, constitutionalists? Come on, think. Think about the implications of that. If, as Barton admitted, there's not a constitutional problem with a Hindu or with a Muslim or with a rabbi or with any cleric of any religion, for that matter, opening the Senate floor with prayer to their false gods, then, hello, 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 hello. I mean, the Constitution, if that's the case, then the Constitution, by that alone, is clearly not a Christian document. But an Antichrist and anti-Christian document. And therefore, if you promote it, you have no business complaining about this pluralistic, polytheistic display of idolatry witnessed this past week. In fact, you're assisting in making such first and second commandment transgressions possible. Put simply, it is high time that we wake up. All of us wake up. All of us Americans, and especially us Christians, and especially anyone today who claims to be a Christian constitutionalist. All right, I think we still have a little bit of time. Let's go back to the Constitution itself, having covered those. And let's see, again, how much further we might get into Article 1. Article 1, let's begin with Article 1 now, Section 5, Clause 3. It says, quote, each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. And the yeas and the nays of the members of either house on any occasion shall at the desire of 1/5 of those present be entered on the journal, end of quote. Well, unlike Yahweh's government, where everything is out in the open, the Senate, it says right here, the Senate and the House has the right to keep things secret if they so choose. And I'll ask again, why shouldn't they? Why shouldn't they? Especially being that the whole constitutional convention was conducted in secrecy. Let me read to you from Gary North's Political Polytheism. And this is a little bit lengthy, but I think you'll appreciate and I don't know if you'll enjoy it, but you'll at least appreciate what Gary has to say on this. From page 417 and 418, under the heading, Sworn to Secrecy. Quote, to conceal the nature of this attempted coup, talking about the Constitutional Convention, to conceal the nature of this attempted coup from the public, especially from any members of Congress, Continental Congress, who did not attend the convention, the debates in Philadelphia were closed to the public. Parentheses, can you imagine the hue and cry of the press and news media if such a convention were closed to them today? No scoops for Pulitzer Prize seeking reporters, no, quote, within a quote, details at 11, end of quote, within a quote, end of parentheses. So secretive were the attendees that Madison, who was the primary engineer of the coup and its unofficially designated scribe, refused to allow his transcripts to be published until after his death. They did not become public until 1840. This code of silence was mentioned by Warren Burger shortly after he announced his resignation as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, who informed a national television audience, quote within a quote, I think one of the reasons of the success of the Constitution was the iron code of silence that bound all the members who were there, end of quote, within a quote. Now, no, he's saying that's a positive thing. Well, I ask you, was it positive? You decide for yourself as we continue. It was not just Madison who felt so bound. Robert Yates, who was at the time Chief Justice of the state of New York, attended the early days of the Constitution. He left in disgust, convinced that the convention served ill purposes. This is a guy now that's opposed to it. He left in disgust, convinced that the convention served ill purposes. He had taken notes of the proceedings through July 5th, yet even this opponent of the Constitution refused to publish these notes. I wonder if there wasn't more, too, some more coercion of holding them to privacy than what we may even know. In the public transcript of them, published first in 1838, his anonymous biographer took great care to explain that Yates had not broken the convention's code of silence. Quote, within a quote, Chief Justice Yates, though often solicited, refused during his life to permit his notes of those debates to be published, not only because they were originally not written for the public eye, but because he conceived himself under honorable obligations to withhold their publication. These notes, after his death, fell into the hands of his widow, who disposed of them, and they are thus become public, end of quote, within a quote. Continuing with with North. When the convention ended, they took the final step. They handed all the minutes over to George Washington to take back to Mount Vernon. They knew that no one in the nation would have the audacity to tell George Washington that he had to hand over the evidence of what was in fact a coup. Madison's notes state specifically that, quote, within a quote, the president, having asked what the convention meant should be done with the journals and whether copies were to be allowed to the members of the Constitutional Convention, if applied for, it was resolved that he retain the, this is quote, within a quote, that he retain the journal and other papers subject to the order of Congress if ever formed under the Constitution, end of quote, within a quote, within a quote, and end of quote, within a quote. You following that? The members, so that was actually a part of what the minutes, what they decided. It was a rule that was decided. The members, this now, continuing on with, that wasn't the end of the quote within a quote. Continuing on with Madison, the members then proceeded to sign the Constitution, end of quote from Madison. North continues, in short, if the coup was successful, now listen to this carefully, if the coup was successful, then the new Congress could gain access to the records. If not, no one would have any written evidence to prove anything except the untouchable General Washington. On that basis, they signed. End of quote from Gary North. The secrecy of the convention was one of the principal reasons why Patrick Henry would not attend, to which he declared, quote, I smelt a rat. End of quote. He didn't only smell a rat. He smelt a strong Masonic secret society influence over the entire affair. Now, they weren't all Masons, but there were plenty there in the Constitutional Convention, and it was that kind of secrecy that was held over the meeting, and perhaps with the same kind of threats that Masons take on death of having their, for example, having their throat slit from ear to ear if they expose the secrecy of the Masons. So, why shouldn't, with this being the case, why shouldn't the Senate and the House of Representatives decide to keep some things secret if that's their choice, based on the fact the whole thing was done and in secrecy and to begin with? All right, continuing on. Article 1, Section 6, Clause 1, Sentence 1. Quote, the senators and representatives shall receive a compensation for their services to be ascertained by law and paid out of the Treasury of the United States. End of quote. Let me just say that. Just say this. There is a heavy tax burden that could be eliminated, could be lifted off the people if we'd only return to Yahweh's perfect law. Because not only would the salaries not be necessary, but neither would the House of Representatives and the Senate. All right, Section 7, Clause 2, Sentences 1 and 2. Quote, all bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as on other bills. Every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. If he approve, he shall sign it, but if not, he shall return it with the objections to that House in which it shall have originated, who shall enter the objections at large on their journal, and proceed to reconsider it. If after reconsideration, two-thirds of that House shall agree to pass the bill, in spite of the President's objections, It shall be sent together with the objections to the other house, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered. And if approved, then, by 2/3 of that house, it shall become a law. End of quote. No, it doesn't. Because there is only one lawgiver, James chapter 4, verse 12, and Isaiah 33 and verse 22, no senator or representative can actually make any law. Any legislation in agreement with Yahweh's law is already law. They can't make that law. It's already law. It's already been law for who probably for thousands of years. And did not need man's ratification to validate it any more than the law of gravity needed man to name it to make it become viable. I'll guarantee, before they called it the law of gravity, you jumped off a cliff, you still paid the penalty. And any law not in agreement with Yahweh's law is immorality, not law. So don't believe for a minute that 2/3 can make it a law. But note here in this section, section 7, clause 2, sentence 2, especially the provision of 2/3 majority being authorized to quote-unquote make law. In other words, think about this whole idea, or think about that anything the Constitution, according to the Constitution, I say, that anything according to the Constitution of the United States of America, anything can be legalized, such as homosexuality and infanticide, which is often called abortion, provided a majority of the Congress and Senate agrees to it. You talk about humanism. Just 2/3 of those 35 or 36 men there? Get 2/3 of them, they can make it a law. They can make murder a law. They can make sodomy, perversion, a law, quote unquote, a law. No, they've just taken immorality and legalized it. In other words, now this is where it really, I think, becomes very important. We're about done here. In other words, the legalizing of these and other abominations, infanticide, homosexuality, and other abominations, is not outside constitutional limits at all. As today's quote-unquote constitutionalists declare they are all of the time. Therefore, do not overlook that the strict constitutionalists are not so much found in today's constitutionalist party, but instead in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, and the United States Supreme Court. They're following right along with what the Constitution says, allows them to do. We need to close. Lord willing, we'll pick this up with Article 1, Section 8 in the next message, unless I receive some more ministry letters that I feel like I just absolutely have to deal with. But hopefully all of this is coming together to help us to see once again we have been bamboozled. There is no Christianity to the document. It is anti-Christianity and, in fact, anti-Christ. Anti-Yahweh and anti-His perfect laws, plain and simple. And that is why we're in the mess we are today. We rejected His perfect laws and went to something that I have to confess, from the past, I've given far, far too much credit to. It wasn't anything close to even what I said it was. It was far worse than that. And it's no wonder we are where we are at today. Let's stand. Let's close in prayer. We need to pray for this nation. We need to pray for the constitutionalists. We need to pray for Christians' eyes to be opened to see what has been done to us and what needs to be done in the future to change the course of this nation. Heavenly Father, we come before you, Lord, for that very purpose. We ask that you would, Father, begin to open the eyes of Americans, of the constitutionalists, of the Republicans and the Democrats and the libertarians, and Father, of your Christian people, or at least those people who claim to be Christian, who regrettably have been serving two gods, if not more, many times as a result of the laws they follow. Bless us, guide us, open our hearts, turn our nation, Lord, once again, back to their real roots, back to the 1600s, and particularly back to your laws, that your kingdom once again might be restored here upon earth as it is in heaven. We ask this, we praise you, Father, for it. In Yahshua the Christ, amen.